judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for this morning is Hess versus Ray Allen Machined.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Michael Haberluska for the plaintiffs and the appellants in this case. Your honors, there are several reasons why the district court's decision should be reversed in this case. First, as a procedural matter, plaintiffs produced evidence to show genuine issues of material fact that should have precluded summary judgment. Plaintiffs cited evidence denying 10 of the defendants' 34 paragraphs of their Rule 56 statement, and they added 134 paragraphs of additional facts which should have precluded summary judgment. That in itself should have ended the case.
I just want to ask you very quickly. At times in their brief, the Hesses talk about a payout.
Yes.
But then they maintain that all they really want to do, it seems, is to move the proceeds from their employee stock into the trustee investment fund.
That's correct, Judge.
Exactly what relief are they seeking?
Initially, they were pro se, and they were writing letters asking what they were entitled to. And one of the first things they asked for was a payout. Then subsequently, after the attorney for the fund told them they weren't entitled to a distribution or a payout, then on June 3rd, 1998, they wrote a letter to the trustee saying specifically they want to transfer their funds from the employer stock fund to the trustee investment fund. And that's a very specific request that went to the trustee. The trustee then sent that letter on to the plan and the plan's attorney with a letter stating that he thought that they could do that under the amendment in question.
So, in other words, all they want to do is move money from the stock plan to the investment fund?
That's correct.
Then can you explain why it's relevant that William Ray received a distribution in 1997?
Because initially they said they're not entitled to a distribution. And they, in fact, would have been entitled to a distribution. They had asked about that question, and they said they wanted to be treated like other participants, including William Ray. They had heard he had gotten a distribution.
But they don't want that relief any longer.
Well, in our lawsuit, we asked for a declaration of their rights. And in my motion for cross motion for summary judgment, I asked for a declaration of their rights. And the declaration of their rights in my cross motion would have been that they would have been entitled to a distribution.
So which is it that they want?
Your Honor, in effect, one part of the plan gives them a right to transfer a certain amount of their account, the contributions prior to 1994, November 30th, 1994, transfer to the trustee investment fund. The other section of the plan, Section 7.4, does entitle them to a distribution.
So which is it that they want?
Well, if they got the distribution, they would be able to roll it over. They're not entitled to take the money without a rollover if they intend to avoid taxes on the claim. In this lawsuit, and we do have another lawsuit pending below in the district court, in this lawsuit we're only asking for the transfer of the funds.
Okay, so that's what they want.
Yes. That's okay. The appeal that they took to the appeal committee.
Okay.
And I just wanted to add one other point about Mr. Ray, who for other reasons, I don't think either advances or detracts from your case, because he had less than $50,000, and Section 7.4 of the plan treats people with less than $50,000 differently from the way it treats people with more than that.
You're correct, Your Honor. It does.
Except his case really has nothing to do with your client's case.
Yes, it does. And let me point out the reason why it does is the entitlement to a determination of the benefits upon termination. And the determination of your benefits is what fixes the amount of money either gets retained for you until you're entitled to a distribution or you get the distribution. The next sentence that you were referring to about under $50,000 goes to those over $50,000. They are entitled to a distribution, but they have to wait 5 years.
Well, nobody's saying, well, I don't know about 5 years. Let me ask
you. Well, it gets paid out over 5 years. I'm sorry.
That it's a payout if you are a less than $50,000 person. You get the payout over 5 years, not if you're a more than $50,000 person.
No, I think you're misreading. It says if you have more than $50,000. It's under Section 7.4.
Right. 7.4A talks about if the vested doesn't exceed $50,000, and cause it to be paid, provided that no more than $10,000 shall be paid in any 1 year. And then it goes on. So it's the $10,000 is definitely relating to the $50,000 people.
Well, Your Honor, right in the middle of that, on page 70 of the plan, if the vested portion of the terminated participant's account exceeds $50,000, then the administrator shall direct the trustee to cause the entire vested proportion to be payable to the terminated participant in substantially equal installments over a period of not more than 5 years. So it does, that same section does apply to people under $50,000 and people over $50,000, and then it goes on to apply for people over $500,000.
And how do you reconcile 4.12G, which you never did put in your brief?
Well, Judge, I think 4.12G is inapplicable to this case, and it's not reconcilable at all. It's apples and oranges. 4.12.
Why is it inapplicable if it's part of this plan?
Well, it's inapplicable to this claim because it's for a distribution of an accrued benefit at age 55 with over 10 years of service.
It's about, 4.12 is about the directed investment accounts. Let's just start with the title.
Okay.
And it begins by saying each participant has the right to direct. That's why, getting back to Judge Rovner's question about whether this is about moving things from the ESOP over into the directed investment accounts, and you just said that's the only thing this case is about. Well, that's what 4.12 talks about, which fund, the employer stock fund or the trustee investment account, is the money going into. And 4.12G talks about changing.
Well, it also talks about a distribution and a determination of the benefits, Judge. It's different than an allocation of where your investment goes and how that investment proceeds. When you're 55, it gives you the right to take a direct distribution of your funds, of your accrued benefit.
How old are your clients?
They are now over 55, but at the time of the claim, they were under 55. They were 53.
Am I correct that even if I want to go on to 412I.
Okay.
Well, there are two things. I'm wondering why they didn't make an argument based on that section to the Appeal Hearing Committee, but even if we adopt your interpretation of 412I, the Hesses would still only be able to move 25% of their employee stock into the trustee investment fund, right?
Yes, that's correct. Each year. You're not limited just once.
At their age now, can they do what the defendant says they can do? That is, take it out? Or
they have begun taking it out, but since 1998, the fund has dramatically been depleted. The value of the company stock went from $9 and something a share down to $2 a share, and what they start taking out after their age 55 is like one-fifth of what it would have been.
Because they couldn't move it into the trustee.
Right.
And but, of course, the market in general tanked, too, around the early 2000s.
You're right, but if you would have had the right and were allowed to, they were allowed to exercise the right, which I believe they had, their funds would have been accrued and placed in a separate account for them. That's what the fund says has to happen.
But you wouldn't be interested if you didn't think that that account, in hindsight, did better than the employee, than the employer stock account.
Judge, they were. They made that request before they knew how it did.
I'm saying you wouldn't be here today if it had turned out. I understand that the timing of their request isn't suspect.
Well, I can't say I wouldn't be here today or not. We don't know what's going to happen for the next several years either. They're still participants in the fund to a certain extent. I think 50% of their money's still there. So I'm not sure I would have been
there. Was that money contributed by the Hesses?
Much of it was until 1995.
Red
they had
Allen
salary reduction contributions. And then the 1995 amendment changed that, stopped employee contributions. And they left in 1996, shortly after the amendment went into effect.
so, I mean, would you know what percentage came from the Hesses, what percentage came from Reg Allen?
Yes, we do. And I believe it's something like 25% or thereabouts. I don't think it's in the record per se in the arguments, but there were statements given to them every year showing how much they put in, how much the company put in. In the value of what they put in and what the company put in. And that would have been based on the company, the value of the company stock at the year of the statement.
Why don't we focus on the fact that this is a plan that gives discretion to the administrator? Because under 412E, the language gives participants the ability to instruct the allocation of future contributions. And under the amendment, 412I, there is a statement about continuing to have the right to direct the investment, except that there aren't going to be future contributions. There's an ambiguity, and we give ties to the administrator when there's discretion.
Well, not unless the court, the district court, which I believe it should have been, should have done, would have found that there was an ambiguity and then did an abuse of discretion analysis. And had they done that, they would have seen that the administrator's rationale was clearly unsound.
There's nothing clear about this case.
I
wish you would not use that word.
I agree. It's not clear. I think it's very, not necessarily complex, but it's confusing based on the language of the plan. I believe it is. And I believe for an ordinary participant it's confusing. And as you can see, the record was voluminous that we were dealing with. But I don't think you give ties to the administrator.
You certainly do when you're reconciling plan language and you're trying to make sense of something that talks about future contributions and something else that's talking about cutting off any future contributions. How do you make it all work together?
It's only if their rationale, if it was a tie, that their rationale made sense under the provisions of the plan.
And why doesn't it make sense?
Because there was no right prior to this amendment to have the participant tell the trustee how to invest the trustee investment fund. The plan language is very clear under 412C that the trustee controls the investments in a trust account. There's absolutely no evidence that anybody ever, other than the trustee, controlled the investment trustee investment account. And in fact, the person that did the day-to-day administration of the plan, Lorraine Morris, who was a board member and a plan administrator, didn't even know what the trustee investment fund was. And I honestly, I don't even think there was one set up. There's no evidence that there was.
Well, there's a lot of language here. I'm even looking at D, but anyway, we'll take a look at it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Thomas?
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Craig Thomas on behalf of the appellee. I'd like to correct a few statements that counsel made regarding some of the questions that the panel had. First of all, he's quoted the highest stock value that the company's ever had in the last 10 years of $9 and the lowest that it's ever had in the last 10 years of $2-plus dollars, not the values that even if they're claim was accurate would apply to the values at the time of their distribution. And as to the question as to what amount of money these people had withheld from the appellants had withheld from their paychecks put into the plan versus what the company put into the plan for their benefit, John Hess had approximately $29,000 over a period of time withheld from his paycheck, which is that the return he's getting quadrupled. It's well over 100 plus thousand. So to put it in context of the money they've taken out of their paycheck and put in, and the same ratio would apply to Jim Hess. He had approximately 17,000 plus withheld from his paycheck over a series of 5 or 6 years and put into the plan.
So are they correct that Reg Allen may have lacked adequate funds to honor their request to transfer their money?
No, they're not correct, Your Honor.
I mean,
what I think that contention stems from is a little bit of a fundamental misunderstanding as to how an ESOP operates. An ESOP is a trust. All the investments are in this trust. This also gets into the argument counsel's made regarding who controls it. The trustee always controls everything in the trust. The question becomes, who has the right in what instances to direct the trustee to say, I as a participant in this plan am directing you to do X. But ultimately, the trustee is the one with the legal authority to effectuate anything with respect to the plan. Your Honor, I'm sorry, I stepped away from your question.
Oh, well, no. I mean, I just was wondering, you know, if the money was in stock, wouldn't Reg Allen just sell the shares?
Your Honor, this is not a publicly traded company. Under federal law, because it's not a publicly traded company and the money's held in the trust, the company, when they set it up, has to say, we will honor a put option. In other words, we'll create the market for a participant mm-hmm. who is selling their stock. So, no, the trust does not retain. Mm-hmm. They'd have to retain two pots of money, one the stock, and then an equivalent value. What happens is each year, pursuant to federal law, there's an independent appraisal done valuing the stock. If stock sold, it's liquidated at that independent appraised value. So Reg Allen would not maintain this, but Reg Allen, simply similar to how they finance the ESOP, would have the ability to more than finance because they're getting value. If they pay a dollar for it, it's for an asset that's worth a dollar that they're buying.
What's the current value of the stock?
The current value of the stock as of this year, I don't have it exactly. It is in the $5 to $6 range. It went down about the time the market went down and has continued to steadily come back up. One thing I would like to focus the panel's attention on is the fact that the only evidence that the appellants presented at the administrative review, and it's clear in the written opinion that came out of that hearing, was the plan document. None of this other evidence was ever presented. And they have tried to then create an issue of fact by filing all this with the district court when the appropriate forum for this is at the administrative committee level.
Why didn't Reg Allen tell the Hesses about the 1998 facts from Llewellyn? Or is that not correct?
Why did they not tell the Hesses? That fax came from the prior owner of the company who's been in litigation with the company over a number of issues over the years. He sends periodic correspondence on a number of things. This correspondence was in the context of a lot of other things, and frankly, if you look at it, it's fairly cryptic as to what he's talking about. There was no reference that said, I understand that these people are pursuing a claim. Here's my interpretation of that. So it was really put in the correspondence along with everything else. We were getting dozens of letters, not only from Mr. Llewellyn related to his issues, but from the Hesses on a number of issues.
What's the size of this in terms of personnel?
They have approximately 100 employees, give or take, and it's a small privately held company. The ESOP was, which is often the case in companies this size, was the funding vehicle for the owner to sell out the company he had started. So now it's being run by people who started as machine tool guys, worked their way up in the company. Now they're on the board of directors and they're running the company. And that gets into another significant issue. These are not people who run ESOPs for a living. These are people who run a machine tool shop for a living. By and large, all of them high school graduates who have worked very hard to get where they are. They relied on the advice of counsel. They work with reputable outfits who do the assist with the administration, who do the trusteeship. They are entitled to significant deference in their decisions when they rely upon experts to advise them on how all of this should accomplish. I'd like to finally just touch.
But aren't there a lot of contradictions here, though? I mean, we're talking about this amendment 4.12i, which certainly does seem to say that people can allocate the contributions that are already in there. Continue to have the right to direct the investment of the participant's account as to contributions made on or before November 30, 1994. Well, that has to mean something. And then if you look at the earlier parts, the main direction in 4.12a is either the employer stock fund or the other fund. One doesn't get a sense of subsets of other.
Your Honor, it does mean something, and it needs to be put in context of the entire provision of 4.2i and the purpose that 4.2i was adopted. Prior to Mr. Llewellyn selling out his stock to the plan, it was determined to do away with these elective deferrals where employees would have money withheld from their paycheck because there potentially were security issues created by them buying somebody's stock, all these people with this money. So what happened is those deferrals were removed from the plan. For clarification purposes, because once they took money out of their paycheck and put it in something other than company stock, they had the right to move it among the investment vehicles that were out there, bond fund
Where's
stock.
Where's that reflected in the plan? Where's this right to move it among other investment funds?
Your Honor, that is not specifically in the plan. It typically is not specifically in the plan documents. It's in the administrative procedures when employees sign up to put money into the plan.
But there's a document someplace in this record that will show that that's the typical procedure?
I don't know for certain that it's in the record, but the typical procedure is in these other investments they would have the opportunity.
But that's a crucial question, really. I mean, if what we're asking is whether the plan administrator abused its discretion in interpreting it the way you've urged that it should be interpreted, it'd be very important to know that the fundamental interpretation that's being offered is one either consistent with or not consistent with.
Well, I think the administrators and the sponsors of the plan have clearly testified in the record and provided evidence in the record that they allowed participants to move the investments periodically that were in these other investments that would be in a more liquid market as opposed to the company stock. That's in the record.
So you're relying on their so their testimony will say this is what we ordinarily
Their testimony did. Will, and quite possibly there's a document. That was not the focus prior to now, so I can't give you a citation to the record. But I think there's no question, and that was never raised by the appellants at any level, that that was an issue, that they had not been allowed to do that.
I mean, they're certainly raising it now. They're saying that they had no say at all because the trustee had total discretion about what the other investment portfolio looked like. I mean, that's what I understood.
Correct, but I think that the testimony is very clear in the record that they were allowed to direct within those other investments where they would put their money.
Prior to that amendment, then, they could direct either the company stock or this portfolio?
Prior to the amendment, what would happen is if they decided they wanted their money in company stock, it went in there, and that's where it stayed until the diversification terms of the plan were satisfied or until they received a distribution. And it
subsection
was
G, you mean?
4.1G, yeah. 4.12G, exactly. That's the diversification. Their claim, to get back to this, is to diversify. That's the diversification section. If they put their money in these other investments, which might be a stock fund, a bond fund, et cetera, they would have the opportunity periodically to direct the movement among those.
But are there some I mean, surely you don't mean that they could just look at, you know, the Dow Jones, you know, or the New York Stock Exchange and say, I'm in a Microsoft mood today, you know, please put the money
in. No, Your Honor, I do not mean that. Yeah. I mean, they were told what funds the trustee had established to allow them to move it among those funds.
Okay.
If there's no further questions, I'll return the balance of my time to the court.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I want to follow up on Justice Wood's inquiry. There is no provision in the plan or in the summary plan document or in any other document in this record that allowed a participant to invest within the other investment fund. The only document is the plan in Section C that says the trustee controls the assets in the other investment account. There is no other, there's nothing in the record, and their testimony was not what counsel said it was.
What plan language can you point to that would make it clear to us that employees were allowed to move money between the stock fund and the trustee investment fund before the 1995 amendment?
I can't. And the reason for that is that it was not part of the amendment. The amendment took away something and added something. And that section I would not have been necessary if all they wanted to do was leave G where the way it was.
Well, sure it would have been if
they wanted to stop the
company's contribution. The first part of I is there shall be no employer's elective contribution. You certainly would have done something with I.
Well, but I was necessary because they took away that contribution. It wasn't necessary to do anything to G. G stood on its own and had a totally different meaning because that was to receive a distribution of your account if you wanted to. You could get your money back. You could get your benefit at age 55. It was like an early retirement type provision. And I also want to focus on the whether or not the corporation could fund the plan, and in fact they could not. The documents that council mentioned, the evaluation of the stock fund for the value of the fund every year. In 1998, they were $6 million in sales. Their gross profit was $1,188,000. Their net income was $492,000. They did not have the money to put in $670,000 into the Hess's fund. And the corporate secretary, Lorraine Morris, testified that they may not have had the money available to do that. And there is a clear conflict of interest here in that Mr. Turner said they'd have to change the corporate plans, their financial plans, if they were to put $670,000 into the Hess's claim.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.